came to Elder Statesman and started speaking out a little bit about different things, and I became a troublemaker. And then in 65, you know, first time I'd been booed by the hometown team. And then 66, you know, I was then 65 season, I was traded. So yeah, we can talk about those type of things.
Can we talk about Pete Rose coming along?
Yeah, sure.
Are we ready? Okay.
Yes, Frank, I wanted to ask you about.
Oh, and Freddie Hutchison. And Freddie Hutchison taking over eventually for Birdie after a couple of interim.
We're talking about the flip side of the Gibson and Drysdale persona, the tough guys. You quickly developed a reputation, don't throw at this guy because he'll take it out on your infielders, he'll make you pay with the bat. How did that come about? Was it something born in you to just retribution, get him back, pay him back?
Well, I don't know if it's born in me, because no one's like to be thrown at, and no one likes to be hit in the head. Although in amateur baseball, I still have the bump back here that I was hit without a helmet, naturally, just the hat. But what it was is I knew when someone was knocking you down or someone was throwing at you it for a purpose. And what it was is to intimidate you. And if they did that or put any doubt in your head, then they were winning the war, and I was losing the war. And I wasn't going to let them do that. And that's the way I was taught, not to let the pitcher intimidate you. And when they would knock me down or hit me, that just made me more determined. And I always had to tell myself and say, don't get upset, because now he has you not really focused and thinking. So it just made me focus better and be more determined that you weren't going to get me out. And the thing about it, you go back to the Coliseum in Drysdale, and we had quite a battle before the All-Star game in 1961 against them, who was going to wind up first at the break. And we were out there, and we had a doubleheader in this game, and we had beat them in the first game, and Drysdale was pitching the second game. And Vader was having a good series. I was having a good series. And Vader was come up. He was hitting in front of me. He was hitting third. I'm hitting fourth. And he threw the ball over Vader's head, knocked him down. And Vader ended up, and he's jawing at him from the mound, and I'm hollering at him from the on deck circle and this. And then Vader gets a walk, and I come up, and the first pitch is over my head. And I go down. And I get up, and I know exactly what it is. No way. And just made me more determined, get a little closer. Next pitch, it went up in the Coliseum seats. And I guess this is what started to develop that back in those days. And then, you know, Gene Mock is the one that came out publicly and said he told his pitchers he would fine them $100 at the time, any pitcher that knocked me down, because when they knocked me down, they only woke me up. And that's all it did to me is, you know, I knew being pitched inside, being brushed back was part of the game. But when you're throwing that intentionally, it's not part of the game. And one of the classic examples of it was 1966, and I get a little ahead of myself, where Earl Williams was with the Red Sox, and we opened up in Baltimore. We opened up in Fenway Park, and the first time up, I got a base hit. Broken bat, base hit. Next time I walked, next time I hit a home run. And Earl Williams was a pretty good pitcher, and he threw nothing but fastballs and sliders and a curveball. Nothing that went down. So we come around, and about a month or so, we play Red Sox at home in Baltimore. And we end the ball game and wound up 1-1, and he had hit a home run about the sixth inning to tie the score at 1-1. And I come up in the ninth inning, and with two outs, and Brooks hit in the inning because he's sitting in front of me, and he got him out, struck him out. And I'm up there, and I'm hitting, and go to two strikes and whatever. And I forget what the count was, two strikes. And he threw a pitch and go, just like that, and I struck out. And after the ball game, Riders was asking me, do you think Earl Williams threw a spitter? And I said, no, I don't think so. I know he does, because he didn't have that pitch when I faced him a month ago. Right. So they go back over, you know, now they go back to Earl. Frank says, you throw a spitter. And he says, well, did you see who hit in that inning? They said, yeah. They say, well, did Brooks complain? No. Well, did anybody else complain? No. They said, well, he says, good hitters don't complain about things like that. So there they come back. You know, I said, oh, is that what he said? Yeah. I said, okay. He will not get me out again. And no, naturally, he did get me out, but very rare. Very rare that I did not hit one or two home runs off of it and whatever. And he was traded to Detroit, and we're in Detroit one day. And I had had a good series, you know, against him before. And then we're up there in the game. I hit a home run. And then this time up, I hit a hard ground ball, one hop, hit the shortstop in the chest. And when I picked it up, threw me out. And I'm going back to the dugout, and he's saying, ha, ha. I said, ha, ha, what? He said, ha, ha, I got you out finally. I said, yeah, but look at your shortstop. He's dead. So that was the type of determination that I had about people that would, you know, kind of not give me the credit that I deserve or whatever, or knock me or throw at me intentionally.
Frank, talk about the beginning years at Cincinnati. You obviously had a good team. There were some changes. Talk about those years and then the change from Tebbets to Hutchinson. Pete Rose comes up. I mean, you've got a lot of interesting developments in those early 60s in Cincinnati.
Well, I did. And as I said, I came up as a 20-year-old youngster and just fit in with the veteran players. And we had some good years offensively early on. But you never could get to the top, although we finished second a couple of years, the Dodgers and those guys. Milwaukee was the big team. St. Louis was the teams to beat, the Dodgers. And we were always kind of winning second and third. And it had been fourth and fifth before. And, you know, in 1956, we had a good hitting team with no pitching. 57, basically kind of the same thing. 58, I had an off year because I got hit in the head during the course of spring training just before the season started. Camilo Cascarel hit me right in the head, right, with a fastball in a minor league ballpark that I couldn't see because there's no background, no hitter's eye. And I didn't pick up the ball, and it hit me without me even moving. And they had
and
to cart me off.
Helmets, so
yeah, it was before helmets, and they had to carry me 125 miles back to Cincinnati in an ambulance and hit every bump in the road. And they said, you know, they examined me and said, you're all right. And the next day I played, and we had two games up in the Baltimore area before we opened the season. And I came back, and I was what we call plate shy then. You know, every pitch I was a little back on my heels, a little bit back on my heels. And I had a terrible time the first half of the season. I like to hit, drove in 23 runs the first half, you know, about 13, 14 home runs, and hit 250 or whatever. But I had a talk with myself between the All-Star break, and then we went out to Seattle to play our AAA club, a game, and I said to myself, if you don't straighten out, you're going to be back in the minor leagues. Do you want to play up here or not? And I said, yes, I do. So I said, I'm going to hit everything the right field tonight, no matter where it is. I had a change up and hit a right field. I had everything in the right field. We played the Giants the next day. I had two home runs and a double, and I was on my way. And I had a great second half, but we didn't go anywhere. And after the 58 season, Birdie was let go, and they brought in Jimmy Dykes. We were doing the middle of the season. It was this rah-rah type guy. Just go out and swing the bat, go out and play. And then here comes Freddie Hutchinson, tough, hard Marine type guy. And he didn't treat me like Birdie did as a young player. You know, it was you do it or not do it. You just like everybody else. And we didn't hit it off. And we had our problems. And it came to a head when I was hurt. I think I had a jammed thumb or something. Couldn't play. We was in Houston. And we were in a close ball game in the late innings, and they needed a pinch hitter. And I was sitting down near the end of the bench, down there just minding my own business, and he walked up and down the bench looking for a pinch hitter, walked by me, walked back by, went down, called on someone else to go up and pinch hit. So after the game, the writers wanted to know, could I have pinch hit? I said, yeah, I could have pinch hit. They said, why didn't you? I said, he didn't ask me. And I said, you know. They said, yeah, but did you tell him you could hit? I said, no, he didn't ask me. I think he should ask me if I could pinch hit. So then after that, it was saying, well, he can't hit right-handed pitching anyway. I said, well, and this is war words in the paper. I said, well, if I couldn't hit right-handed pitching, I wouldn't be here. Because there's not that many left-handers in the league anyway, and there wasn't that many in the minor leagues. I said, that's what got me here, hitting right-handed pitching. And it went on like that for a while. But in 1963, 64, down the road, we became to understand each other better as he was there and understood he's the manager and, you know, he has the last say anyway. And it was a tough situation because he contracted cancer. And we had a chance to win. After 61, we won, and we got wiped out by the Yankees in the World Series, like we didn't belong there. Although that series could have been closer than what it was, because it was 2-1, and we came back to Cincinnati. I'm sorry, 1-1, and we were leading in the third game of that series until a pop fly came out the right short right center field, and myself and the second baseman Elio Chacon got tangled up in our signs, and the ball fell, and they beat us 3-2.
Just tell the people game. Down the road who was on that Yankee team. That was
Mantle, Maris, Elston Howard, Cleet Boyer, all those guys.
Kubek.
They had an all-star team. And we were just a bunch of what they call us that year, a bunch of ragamuffins. collection from all different teams.
Whitey Ford,
with all his streak of, again, scoreless innings in the World Series. And Whitey was pretty tricky. And they beat us really on nothing else. I mean, they had good team, but experience, if nothing else. It was our first time there, and you know, we were a little But I wanted to get back. I just couldn't wait to get back. I said, we're better than this. I'd like to get back. So 64, we had a good chance, but Hutch had cancer, and to see a man big, strong like him, healthy, 6'4", 225 pounds or whatever, dwindled away to 190 pounds and could hardly straighten up, and him still managing the ball club is kind of tough, going out and focusing on the game and seeing him on the bench. And we battled down to the last series in that 64 year, and we lost it. But I think if he'd have just taken a break, got away from the team a little bit, and let Dick Sisler run the team in 64, we probably would have won that in 64, but we didn't. And then 65, I came back, and it was the first time that Sisler took over. And I was having a pretty good year. And then one stretch, I was over 22. And I didn't know if I was going to get another hit early in the year. And it was the first time I was booed by the home fans, and it really hurt. And I just wanted out. I didn't say it, but I wanted out. I said, they don't respect me anymore. The heck with me. I don't want to be here. And Bill DeWitt took over that year for the first year as general manager. And I was used to going in and to the office, because I stayed in Cincinnati the 10 years I was there. I stayed there in the off season, and going in, and I could see Gabe Paul just like that in a second, because he would make the time. Come on in, sit down and talk. And I was used to that. So when he took over, I went down to talk about my contract before I left to go to California before the holidays. And he made me wait an hour and a half before I kind of went in. And the first thing he said to me when I walked in there, before I sat down, he says, I hear that you don't always hustle. I said, what? I hear your reputation, you don't always hustle. I said, I don't know who you heard that from, but I give it my all every time. I say, I don't run from the outfield at 100%, because what does that prove? But when there's a play to be made or whatever, I give it 100%. Well, that's not what I heard. So he said, I'm going to have to cut your salary. Hey, I said, wait a minute. I said, I hit very well in 1964. I hit over 300 and whatever, da-da-da-da. He says, I don't care, I'm cutting it.
Now, again, tell the people down the road, because they won't realize this necessarily. You worked on a system of one-year contracts every year. This was before long-term contracts, before the union, before a lot of things.
Right.
So explain that. You didn't have an agent. You were in there on your own. You had no cards. If you didn't sign, you didn't play.
Well, that's right.
I think people have to understand that.
Well, that's right. You didn't have an agent. And you own a one-year contract, and that wasn't too bad. I don't think that's too bad. That wasn't the biggest thing about it. But it's just that they wasn't going to pay anything, you know. The thing about it is, in days like that, is, you know, if you had a good year, the team had a bad year, say, in the standings or whatever, you go in, you want to raise, expect to raise, and they say, well, hey, team didn't do well. But I did. Well, still, we didn't make any money,
but
so we can't.
But you couldn't go anywhere. That you either
no.
sat home.
No, you were there. I was there from the time I signed as coming to Pro Bowl in 1953. They had you. They could trade you, but you couldn't go anywhere. They had you until that was it. Until they wanted to release you or whatever, you were stuck with the organization you signed with, and they knew it. And the only threat, when you went in to negotiate your own contract, sitting across that table, some of the things they used to tell you, talk about you so bad, it made you feel bad, you know. And I used to go in there, and he was telling me that he says, you had an off year this year. I said, yeah, I didn't hit as well as I hit last year, but I still led the team in batting average, home runs, and RBIs. I still had a good year as far as this team is concerned. He said, yep, I'm going to have to cut you.
And did you have to put up the same sort of fight even following your MVP year?
MVP
year. You
still
have to prove.
What was that? MVP year?
Yeah.
You know what they offered me the first time there? $5,000 raise after MVP year 1961.
Now, Frank, if you don't mind, I hope you don't, but again, for historical purposes, you're MVP and you're making how much money and you want a raise. So give people 50 years from now a sense of what life was like.
MVP year, I was making $30,000 going into the year. I felt like I would get a raise to $40,000 at least, you know, and maybe 50. But they offered me $5,000. And I had a battle. I had a battle and not threatened to hold out because, you couldn't go to spring training unless you had signed your contract. And that's what they would hold over your head. And they would sit and wait because they felt like, you know, you weren't making a lot of money in those days, and that's before taxes, believe me, the $30,000. And then, you know, you're living, you know, you had to play for that, get that salary the next year. And they would just sit and wait until you signed the contract. And usually, you know, you didn't want to go to spring training halfway through. You wanted to go and get yourself in shape to go have the good year the next year. And so I battled with them for quite a while. And wound up getting a $20,000 raise on that, but it was tough.
What led to your being viewed as I heard you say earlier as a troublemaker?
Yeah.
What led to sort of the disenchantment with Cincinnati and the trade to Baltimore? Because in baseball history, that's a significant event. You're the unique guy. You went from MVP in one league to MVP in another. Nobody's ever done that. Talk about that again for people down the road. They're going to be very interested in that.
Well, I had gotten out of my shyness a little bit over the years, and when your Klaziskis and your Bells and your Posts and the veteran guys had moved on, I became kind of the spokesperson for the players and the team. And in those days, when you were troublemakers, when you would speak out against management or whatever, speak up for what you felt like was right. And most of the time, it wasn't my problems that I was speaking of. It was teammates' problems. They would come to me, Frank, you're the big guy on the club. You know, you could go talk to them, and they're not doing this. I'm unhappy with this or that. And I would always take the problems of my teammates to management as my own problem. I would never say, Faye said, or Faye wants. It was always like it was my problem. And when you would speak up or speak out against management, they would classify you as a troublemaker. And this is what I became as a troublemaker. And I was also bad for the young player, Vader Pinson, coming along too, in that because I influenced him and he wasn't getting his proper rest and that kind of stuff and whatever. And also when I get traded, and the idea was why? Because in those days, did not trade your good players to the American League or the National League. The American League trade top players to the American League. You just didn't. You trade them within the league, maybe, but never across the line. And Bill DeWitt's excuse was, I was old 30. And whatever that meant, I don't know to this day. Because I played hurt. I averaged about 152 games in a 154-game schedule. And I averaged, when it went to 168, I averaged about 164 games. So I played hurt.
And who did Cincinnati get? Tell people.
Well, they got a pitcher, which was one of Baltimore's better pitchers at the time. They said Bill Pappas, Jack Balshan, who was with the Phillies for a number of years, a reliever. but he had had his better year. He was just traded to Baltimore that winter, and was way beyond being a prospect. Dickie Simpson with the Angels, the Angels, looks like back then. And those are the three players. And Simpson and Boston did not play a game in the Baltimore uniform. So those three was traded for me, and they asked him, why did he trade? He said, first of all, he said, well, we needed pitching. And I said, well, I can understand that. But then he came back, they pressed him, and they come back with the, he's an old 30. And they asked him, what did he mean? He says, well, I'll explain it to you sometime during the season, around July or something. We'll just wait and see how he does over there. And then Milt Pappas, also words was, he hit a lot of home runs here in this ball, small ballpark, but he won't hit the home runs in that big ballpark in Baltimore. And my concern was, you know, when he scrapes his knuckles up against that center field fence when he gets ready to throw a pitch, he's gonna be afraid to throw the ball over the plate. And I said, if I hit it on the nose, it's gonna go out of any ballpark, so the Baltimore ballpark. So he had an off year.
I take it was
year.
A little motivation when you got
absolutely.
To Baltimore.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, because number one, though, I didn't have to go there to prove anything to myself. I knew I could still play the game. And the fans knew I could still play the game. But I said, I'll show DeWitt. I'll show him, you know. And I said, I want to show Baltimore that they're getting a good ball player also. But in 1964, I almost didn't make it because we had a team party, you know. And you always had a team party. And the funny part about it, this mortician put it on for us, you know. And it always at his house. And he had a pool in the back. And I don't swim. I don't swim to this day. And I respect water. I can get in water, but I don't play with water. I don't fool around and get careless in water. So as, you know, the guys had a few, you know, and then they want to go around and throw people in the pool. So I'm laying on, sitting on a chair, lounge chair, and they come to pick me up and throw me. And I said, boo, you know I don't swim, so don't do it. And they kept insisting. I said, okay, tell you what. Let me go in and put a tray of swimming trunks on, because I got my wallet and my vest and papers and stuff, and I don't want to get them wet. So they put me down. I went in, came back out, walking towards the pool, and I'm going to outsmart them. I'm just going to slip into the pool, get wet, stay in there a little bit, then get out. But, you know, it's private pools, you know, it's no marking where the deep end is. So I get in and go right down the deep end. So now I'm sitting on the bottom. I come up and I go, help, help, help. And all my teammates, my wife, and everybody sitting right around, standing around the pool, looking at me. Huh? I come up again, help, 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 help. Go back down. Come up third, help, help, help. Boom, back down. I'm sitting on the bottom. Sitting on the bottom. Here's the headline, just like, you know, curveball sending Robinson to minors. Robinson drowns at team party. Bill DeWitt gets last laugh. I'm sitting there. I'm gone. There's one thing I told myself, though, don't take in any water, but I'm sitting there. So eventually I feel this hand and start up, unless we go. Oh, hey, what happened here? So it's Andy Etchebarren, and later on he told me, he says, I didn't know whether you was joking or not, and I didn't take any air. So when I went down there to get you, I had to come back up and get some more air and come back and pull you up. So he pushed me over to the side, and I got out, and I had no water in my lungs or nothing. Got out and walked around. And after I looked at the pool and whatever and thinking about it, I said, you dummy, all you do is crawl over to the side and get out. But it just didn't dawn on me to do it. Sure. And I was sitting there. I'm gone. That's what I figured. I'm gone. So I was thankful for that. I got out of 64 the 66 season in Baltimore like that. And
but now that was a great team. You joined a pretty good team.
Well, I knew it. Yes.
Talk a little bit about that team. You had some wonderful players and you had wonderful pitching. Well, and talk about Weaver, because that's a significant.
Well, Bauer. Hank Bauer, was at the time 66. I knew I was going to a good team because 2 years previously they had wound up second to the Yankees. And in 64, 65, they had wound up second again, like I say. And I knew some of the names. I knew Brooks was there. I knew Boog. And that's about the names that I knew. Because when I got the call, and it came from Phil Sege, who was assistant general manager at the time, and I was eating dinner, getting ready to go bowling, and my wife said, telephone. I said, who is it? She says, Phil Sege. I said, this is December. The run of meetings are over. My name is bounced around a little bit. I thought I was safe. Hello. Frank, it's Phil Sege. I just wanted to call you and tell you you've been traded to Baltimore. I said, where? Baltimore. For who? Milt Pappas, Jack Balshan, Dick Simpson. Well, okay. Well, I want to thank you. Click. So my wife said, what is it? I said, we've just been traded. She said, where? I said, to Baltimore. She says, where? I said, Baltimore. And that killed my dinner. I went, Vincent went bowling that night in the league. Pretty good bowling. Won my worst three games I ever rolled in my life. And for about 3 or 4 days, I didn't leave the house. I just couldn't leave the house.
Now tell people about that. I mean, obviously your pride is hurt. You're annoyed. You're somewhat frustrated.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what goes through a ballplayer's mind when you're MVP and you're traded.
Well, you know, that was the first time it happened. And you feel not wanted.
Yeah.
You feel like you did something that was wrong. You feel like you let the team down and whatever else. There is a negative to think about. And the one thing, you feel crushed because I signed with the organization. I spent 10 years. That was my 10th year that I just finished that summer. And I was thinking about maybe finishing my career.
You have roots there in the community.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you make friends on and off the field. And you just feel like it's something wrong with you as a person and as a player. And you're not wanted here now anymore. It's just out. And as I said, I didn't leave that other than to go bowling that night because I felt like I should do that because of my teammates.
Now, nobody from Baltimore called you to make you feel
no.
somewhat better about coming over there?
No. No. Yeah.
Did it also have something to do with National League, American League? Like you said, it was
no.
it was not a usual thing to leave the league like that?
No. I didn't think about that in that no. time. You know, I'm going to American League, I'm going to National League. No. Yeah. It's just where I was going, Baltimore.
You had that earlier bad experience.
Yes, yeah, what I said, the flashback there, too. Right. I said, boy, I don't want to go to that city. But
and
I remember.
By the mid-60s, Baltimore had not changed.
Not much, I found out.
As a matter of fact, your trade, to put it in context for the people 50 years down the road, your acquisition had a lot to do with change.